I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Stephen Miller joins me now, the author, playwright, and actor, has written a new novel, I believe his sixth, The Messenger. Its backdrop is the War on Terror, and it's a timely story about a young woman, Daria, a terrorist, whose mission is to go to the United States, blend in, and infect as many Americans with a strain of smallpox that she's carrying. Another character in the book is Dr. Sam Waterman. He's a disgraced American scientist who's brought back to locate the threat. It's a book described as having a riveting plot and as Mr. Miller's best. His previous books include The Woman in the Yard, Field of Mars, and The Last Train to Kazan. Stephen Miller also boasts numerous acting credits, including an award-winning stint as Detective Zach McNabb on Da Vinci's Inquest, also on episodes of The X-Files and Millennium. He is appearing at the Vancouver International Writers and Readers Festival on a couple of panels, Wednesday the 17th of October at 1 p.m., Saturday the 20th of October at 2 p.m. Visit writersfest.bc.ca for more information. His own website is at stephenmillerwriter.com. The Messenger is published by Delacorte Press, which is an imprint of Random House. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Stephen Miller. Mr. Miller, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So, Daria, what's she like?
Daria is just a young girl, maybe 21, 22 tops. She just wants to have fun. She made the decision to become a terrorist at a very early age out of sort of desperation. But she's not really politically astute. She believes all the things she's been taught to believe, but really fundamentally she's just a kid, and she is told right away, because she's really going to be a sleeper, just to forget all, just to be like the other girls. And they, in the plot of the story, she is taken to finish her schooling in Italy, at an expensive private boarding school, and she's just told to just blend in and have fun. And so she does. She goes to clubs and she meets boys and she rides on a motorcycle and she smokes hashish, and she's just. She doesn't really, the idea of creating Daria was just to try to create someone who was in many ways politically naive.
We don't know her background, I guess, right?
Her background is purposely obscured. I didn't want to make her a member of any particular sect, yeah, or from any particular country, which actually there was a mistake made when the publisher sent out the advanced reading copies, and yeah, they said she was from Iraq,
yeah,
but she's not. She's not. We're not pinning her down, because I wanted to make her generic.
Yeah, and then the other character is Dr. Waterman.
Dr. Waterman, yes. Yeah. He's based on a real guy.
Stephen Hatfield?
Stephen Hatfield.
Yeah. Hatfield. Phil?
And who was one of the scientists in the Fort Detrick USAMRID labs, who was wrongfully implicated in the Amerithrax, the anthrax letters. That was when they spread the white powder in the mail.
After 9/11.
Yeah, and yeah, the FBI identified him by name. And he eventually sued and won a $5 million judgment. He's originally from South Africa. He was very much a bio-warrior. He was involved in the South African bio-warfare program. And he's not really a great guy, but this character is sort of based on him, his career. Sam Waterman's career is based on Stephen Hatfield's career.
So Daria is radicalized. And
yes,
she's sent on this mission to go to New York, and she's infected with smallpox.
Mm-hmm.
And Waterman's role is to try to find her, or to get her before she does more damage, I guess, right?
Well, that's basically,
yeah,
it, yes. They don't know that it's her. They don't know that it's one person. It might be more people. Waterman's brought in because he's one of the last guys standing from the old dirty era of bio-warfare. And he was also, in the novel, a leader of a thing called Project Bacchus, which was a real project, which was designed to see how cheap and how portable a group could make a bioweapon. And they did it with off-the-shelf equipment and put it in an Airstream trailer, and I think the price tag, if you eliminate the wages and all the government, you know, benefits, came out at around $100,000. So it's not a, you know, it was a real project, and that's why I highlighted that project in the novel.
Do you look in the book, because I haven't read the book, obviously, mm-hmm. Do you look at what sort of motivates Daria to do all this?
Somewhat. There's a book cited in the, I can't remember the name of it right now.
I'll dig here
in the sources and acknowledgments. Hold on just a second, listeners. It is, let's see, regarding Terra. Oh, yes, here it is. By Alice Lo Cicero and Samuel J. Sinclair, Creating Young Martyrs, Conditions That Make Dying in a Terrorist Attack Seem Like a Good Idea, Prager Publishers, from Westport, Connecticut, in 2008. And that was a very interesting book.
Yeah.
And it's it was, a lot of it was about the terrorists in Sri Lanka, who were some of the early pioneers of children, using children as terrorists. And so Daria's kind of mindset and recruitment is based on information found in that book, where a lot of times a young person, particularly if their father or brother or mother or sister has been killed or wounded or grievously injured by, say, the government or some force, will have a deeply held desire to strike back. And, you know, we were talking earlier about the political sophistication of this. And Daria is not really politically sophisticated, and a lot of these young kids aren't. So that's sort of where she comes from.
Yeah. And so where does the hatred of the West, where do you think that comes from?
I think it comes partly because I'm just putting this out for my own, really, as an actor. I mean, if you don't have anything and you're in a crappy situation and you're born into that and everybody you know is in that, there's a lot of resentment. And if you're constantly being portrayed in the Western media as the villain, you know, if when you look at a Sylvester Stallone movie or a you know, and all the villains look like your loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after a while, you start thinking, "Hey, there's a problem here." And you know, I don't think it's a big stretch to resent the policeman on the block, you know, at all. So,
as a writer, as an artist, a novelist, as a citizen, do you think that in writing a book, you use these characters to sort of unpack what you think about contemporary issues, say?
I do that to a certain extent.
Yeah.
I think, excuse me.
No, that's fine.
I think a lot of writers do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I use the novels. I mean, I know I do. I try, in a sort of a way, I try not to. But I know that partially I write about stuff that is interesting to me or pisses me off or, you know, things I'd like to correct or that kind of thing, sure.
And the sort of the bioterrorism that Daria is set to commit in the book, does it surprise you that it hasn't happened?
Yes, it does. I talk about that a little bit in the sources and acknowledgments. It's I use smallpox in this because people know what smallpox is, and smallpox is very lethal, even in its ungenetically modified form.
Yeah.
It kills 1 in 3. It wouldn't have to be smallpox. You know, smallpox is very hard to get. It's been locked away in super secret laboratories now for decades. But it could very easily be something else. It could be Ebola. It could be dengue fever. There's a lot of things that you could that a terrorist could modify. Avian flu, SARS. You know, there's plenty of material out there. You know, if you wanted to just poison people, you could make botulin. You and I could go out here in your garden and make botulin right now.
We'll do that after the interview.
Half an hour. Yeah, we'll do it after the interview. We'll make some botulin. You know, and it would be lethal. You could, you know. So it's often called the poor man's nuke, because it's way easier to do bio warfare and way cheaper than to try to build a bomb that can be detected from outer space. I mean, that's just crazy.
Or hijack a plane.
Yeah, or hijack a now hijack a plane. Back in 9/11, almost 12 years ago.
12 years ago tomorrow. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was very easy to hijack a plane. All you needed was a box cutter. So.
Yeah. Just thinking about that, because we're recording this September 10th. Mm-hmm. The world has changed a great deal in the last 12 years, hasn't it?
Very much.
Like, this novel probably would not have been written. It could have been written, I guess, but it would have been called science fiction, perhaps, right?
Well, it might have been, and it certainly wouldn't have the impact, and it wouldn't be, I mean, you'll see when you do read it, it wouldn't resonate the same way by any means. I mean, in the novel, she goes to the World Trade Center, you know, and walks around and looks at the memorial, and everybody else is grieving, and inside she's happy.
Yeah.
Because this has been the supreme achievement of the people that she identifies with, to bring these towers down, you know, just to show them, just basically to give the finger to, you know, the dominant power on the globe. So, you know,
Have these characters have they got traits of you? I mean, you've created them. You're the writer. Do you put yourself into? I mean, is it like a Hitchcock thing? Do you put yourself?
Well,
into them?
Waterman is exactly my age,
yeah.
And he's kind of grumpy and crotchety like I am, and he's cynical, and I think he's probably got a little bit of my wit, my sort of sarcasm, and my what I'd like to think is my dry wit, but people who know me might just think I'm an idiot, but Waterman, I guess, is much closer to me than anybody else in the book, for sure.
Yeah, and just back to the idea of where we are sort of in history, these last 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know a little bit about you, having read about you, and I've actually seen you on stage in something. Do you think, I mean, you came to this country from, mm-hmm. from the United States in the
68,
mm-hmm. yeah. Are the times comparable, like where we are today in the sort of war on terror and what happened in 1968?
Well, in 1968, I remember, and in that period of time, it was very, very, very scary. You know, it was scary. There were riots. The Black Panthers were, you know, rising up. I drove across the United States the weekend of Kent State.
Wow.
When the students were killed at mm-hmm. Kent State in Ohio. And every, with my girlfriend, and everywhere we went on the local radio, the local states were going to be calling out the National Guard that coming weekend, because they knew in their universities there were going to be these huge protests. And there were. And the FBI was very much involved in a program called COINTELPRO, which was basically just a massive domestic spying program. Vietnam was going on and didn't show any sign of coming to an end. It was consuming people at a huge rate. It was taking the poorest, because it was a draft, unlike now. They learned their lesson, you see, in the United mm-hmm. States. They can't go to war now with and have a draft. I mean, mm-hmm. there would just be, it would be like the 60s all over again if they yeah. put in a draft. And it was a very, very dark time. And now, I think what's happened is, by externalizing the threat, by making the threat an offshore threat, terrorists from abroad and Islamic fundamentalists, that in a way that's pulled the United States closer together. In the 60s, we were fighting against ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're not doing that so much. But I think if we keep going through these cycles where we have, on one hand, kind of perpetual war, I mean, we've been fighting for 12 years now, mm-hmm. Iraq and Afghanistan. And if we keep having these perpetual wars, and then domestically we keep having this solution that says, hey, you know, cut everybody's taxes, you know, and just let the rich people run everything, as if that's going to solve it.
Yeah.
And when I think the problem is way bigger than that. And if we continue doing this sort of thing where we deny that there's any kind of reason to get involved in doing anything environmentally, by the time my son is my age, I think it's going to be really, really a lousy place to live.
Yeah. At the back of the book, there's a few pages of sort of the research that you did, mm-hmm. the books that you read. Was there a lot of travel?
There was a little bit of travel. I was unable to travel. I wanted to follow her route across the... What happens in the book, just, and I don't think this is a spoiler, she goes to New York to start her campaign of infection, and then she thinks that they're on to her. And she gets scared, and she runs. And she rents a car, and then she gets on a bus, and then she gets on the train, and then she rents another car. And she's just going on a road trip across the United States. And I wanted to do was follow her route across the United States, but I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
I didn't have the time. I didn't have the money, and So I did it by using Google Street View.
Yeah.
I Street Viewed her all the way across the United States, which is the only thing I really could do. And I had friends in a couple of those locations, and I said, tell me, you know, what's this area like around Arizona, and blah, blah, blah. So that's sort of the way it worked.
Was it fun writing this book?
Well, I love writing.
Yeah.
You know, if I was in jail, first thing I'd ask for would be pencil and paper.
Yeah.
I mean... So in that regard, yes, it was fun. It was very dark. It's, you know, a lot of heavy stuff to deal with. It was not nearly as much research as I had to do for my two previous books, which are both set in Russia in 1913 and 1918. So there's a lot of research there. But yeah, sure. In many ways, it was fun.
Yeah. Do you write every day?
When I'm writing, I write every day. I write every day, usually from breakfast until lunch, you know, and I come up for air, and then I do everything else that I've got to do in the afternoon. And then if I'm really going I'll sometimes go back and do it again, at night. And usually when I do that, I'm rewriting, I'm just cleaning things up. I'm not doing the sort of creation type writing.
Yeah. You know? Say if you're on set somewhere. Far away.
Oh yeah.
Would you be writing then?
Oh yeah. When I was on Millennium, I was a regular on the TV series Millennium for the third season and last season of that show, and I had a trailer, and so I would come in and I would just bring my laptop and I'd just hole up in the trailer and I could get a chapter done each day I was at work.
Yeah.
You know, and then they'd call me and I'd do the scene and I'd come back and I'd write some more.
Does the acting part of your life? Does that inform writing, do you think?
Very much.
Yeah.
It's acting and theater, and this goes for everybody who might be listening to this and their children, is a wonderful thing to do. It really does help you. It helps you learn about yourself, and it helps you learn about other people, and it turns you into an observer of the human condition. And so the acting has really helped me that way. It's also helped me with dialogue and learning kind of how things fall off the tongue. And sort of when you write something, how sometimes when you write something, it doesn't really sound right. It might look right on the page, but if you had to say it, you would want to rewrite it. Sometimes you have to make compromises there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's helped a whole lot.
Do you read the reviews? I mean, the National Post said that this is your best novel to date.
I know. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I do read reviews, and I've always read reviews, but the problem with reviews and critics is you can't really take them, you can't really believe them. If you're going to believe them when they're good, you got to believe them when they're bad. And so I read them because sometimes somebody will say, a critic will say something in the book, about the book or about a play that you're in or a movie, and you learn something from that can make you better next time. But so I do read them, but I try not to pin any of my ego to them. I'm glad I'm getting good reviews, because nowadays with books, you may have heard this from everybody else, it's so hard to get publicity out and let people know that the book is even out there. I mean, so the reviews are important, just as publicity, if nothing else.
Yeah.
So,
This is a Delacorte, I guess, is an American imprint, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So, do you go to the States and promote the book there? Or?
Well, not really. I had my agent is Denise Bukowski. She's a Canadian agent, really, really a lovely gal, and and very good agent. And she sold it to Kate Misiak, my editor at Delacorte, who's the vice president there, and she's a terrific editor. So I got very lucky that way. And so most of all of it was done over the telephone and by email. And then I did go there in last March to sort of meet all those folks. And they want you to have a book trailer. Yeah. So I went there and I shot the book trailer. So if you get some time, check out the book trailer.
It's on YouTube, I think.
On YouTube, yeah. The Messenger by Stephen Miller with a PH and book trailer. And you'll actually see one of two book trailers there. Mm-hmm. So that was lots of fun. And I hired an actor there, and I shot that all myself and cut it myself, and my son did the music, and I really enjoyed making this little movie all about my book. So,
Do you think audiences in this country will react to the book differently than, say, in the United States?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
And what do you think, what's the difference there, do you think?
Well,
is it threats, not us, for us?
The Twin Towers killed some Canadians, but it's not on our soil. It's not a crime against us. It's a crime. We're really good in Canada at saying we're not the United States, even though we pretty much follow right along in their footsteps, particularly now with the current government. And we, so when it's convenient for us, you know, we're not the United States. Mm-hmm. We're adept at listing all the ways we're not Americans. Yeah. And then when we want to be Americans, it's okay, you know. I mean, so it's something we can very easily say it's not us, it's not our problem, it's not our war. When if somebody's against the great Satan, I mean, you know, we're really close to being, you know, we live right next door to the great Satan.
Do you go back to the state? I guess yes. This is home for you now, right?
Yeah, this is home. I've been here since 68, and I live here, and I have a family and everything. So I do go home. My mother recently passed away in North Carolina, and I was just down there with my family, and we still have our home down there, and you know we're dealing with all that. And there's a family business down there that I have a little tiny fraction of, and. So, yeah, I still have ties. Yeah.
Would you indulge me? I read in your bio that the publisher sent. You carried Betty Davis down a set of stairs.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. What was that in?
That was a movie called A Piano for Mrs. Cimino.
Ah, okay.
And it was a story about Alzheimer's. It was made, I guess, in the 80s. And she was being taken out of her house, which she didn't want to leave. And I was one of the emergency medical guys who came and got her. And the house they picked was over in Shaughnessy area. And it was an old house with concrete steps that were actually the pitch of the steps was quite steep.
Yeah.
And I don't think that you would be allowed to make steps like that anymore because of the code, the building code. But they were concrete painted steps, and it was kind of a gray, slightly rainy day, and I was thinking, oh, God, man, you know, I'm going to drop Betty Davis. And she's not very big. She's a little bitty woman.
Right? Yeah.
She's like, you know, 90 pounds soaking wet, and I thought, oh, I'm going to drop this. You know, she's in her 80s.
Yeah.
I think I'm dropping. She'll just shatter, you know. I was terrified. I was with another guy, but we got her loaded in the ambulance and got away with it, and I didn't drop her.
Yeah.
it was really one of those.
What was she like to you?
Well, she was very, very. She was nice, but she was very much a professional, and she was just doing what she was doing. And I didn't have a very large part. I had maybe two or three lines in that scene. The part was given to me by a wonderful man named George Schaefer, who had directed several things up here, one of the great legends of live TV. But we were in the room of the house, and the woman who owned the house was there, and we're waiting for them to set up the shot, and they told us to wait inside because it was raining. And the woman said to her, Miss Davis, have you ever been to Vancouver before? And she was standing right at the window. She didn't even turn around. And she said, yes. In her Betty Davis voice.
Yeah.
She said, yes. And then she listed the time she'd come up here. And she came up here, I think, the first time in the 20s and drove across Canada.
Huh.
Okay? she used to come up fishing with John Wayne and his crowd.
Yeah.
She listed about six times she'd been, and she'd been all over BC. She'd been all over Western Canada doing stuff like climbing mountains with William Wyler and all this crazy stuff that, like, nobody in the room had ever done any of that stuff.
Yeah.
And she just, we all just went like, whoa, you know, like, gosh, you know, I guess I better get out my book and do some of this stuff like Betty Davis did back in 1930, you know. It was amazing.
Yeah. It's been such a delight to have you
Thank here. You. Same here.
And I'm looking forward to reading this book. In the back, you also say that you take Amtrak a lot?
Yes, I love Amtrak.
I took it once a couple weeks ago. And
oh, yeah.
I just fell in love with
Where'd you go, down to Seattle?
I went from Seattle back up.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And I just, it's the only way to go, I guess.
Yeah, it's terrific.
Yeah.
And I love that trip from Vancouver to Seattle, or vice versa, because you're actually closer to the water than the road.
Exactly, yeah.
And you have wonderful views all the way down.
Yeah.
And those are nice little cars, those cars they've got on that line. But I've been across, I've gone VIA and I've done Amtrak. I like VIA better, but it's so much more expensive. And the food is better on the VIA. But I've taken the sleeping cars, and I've had bedrooms. I've done it at least across the country at least six times.
You don't like flying, or?
I hate flying. Yeah. I just think you're treated like a dog now when you go to the airport and get on a plane. Yeah. It takes, you have to add 3 hours to your total time, you know, when you fly. And there's nothing, you couldn't call it comfortable unless you've got a fortune and you can go first class.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's a miserable way to travel. I'd much rather take the train. And people used to do it all the time, you know. So why not me, you know?
I'm sure Betty Davis took the train.
I'm sure Betty Davis took the train. And I would love to travel by boat across, you know, the Atlantic and the Pacific. I'd love to do that.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Those are hard to do. It's just cruises now. It's just like tourist cruises, not for transportation.
Yeah.
It's too bad.
I'm really looking forward to reading the book. It's called The Messenger. It's published by Delacorte Press, which is an imprint of Random House. The website, StephenMillerWriter.com, with a PH in Stephen. And, of course, the two events at the Writers' Fest in October. Writers,
and Word on the Street.
Word on the Street as well.
Coming up. Yeah.
WritersFest.bc.ca, and then the Word on the Street website, which I don't have written down. Stephen Miller, the author of The Messenger, joined me in studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.